browse our online courses and transform your academic journey.
On Saturday, September 21st, two perennial powerhouse programs in the OUA will go toe-to-toe at Richardson Memorial Stadium. Your Queens Gaels will host the Guelph Griffins. Last year, the Gaels and the Griffins waged war in a classic contest that went down to the wire. Can the Griffins get their revenge, or will the Gaels stay golden at Richardson Stadium? There's only one way to find out, and that's to tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Join us for our pregame show at 2:45 p.m. Kickoff is scheduled for 3. Trust me, folks, you don't want to miss this one.
CFRC 101.9 FM has opened applications for its 2024-2025 Musicians in Residence program. Young and emerging artists are encouraged to apply to use CFRC studio space as an incubator to create new music, perform it live on air with video simulcast, take part in industry-related workshops for bands who are just starting out, and get paid. Learn more and apply today at CFRC.ca.
Kick your shoes off at the door.
G'day and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's and at other Ontario universities. My name is CJ the DJ and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if you mates miss the show at any time, you know you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. But today, though, I'd like to introduce you to Janelle Renier-Davies from Toronto Metropolitan University, or TMU for short, who is doing a PhD in Environmental Applied Science and Management under the supervision of Dr. Sarah Edge. Welcome to Grad Chat, Janelle.
Thanks for having me, Colette.
So we've got another one. Yes, I know a few weeks ago I talked to another student that was actually from Wilfrid Laurier, Debbie, who was at the late shift, which is where I got to meet these wonderful students. And Janelle was another one, this time from TMU. So Janelle, what did you think about the late shift?
Oh, it was amazing. I just emailed the director of my program yesterday saying how it was so nice to have a chance to just kind of ignore the rest of the world for a little bit and focus on my work. And also, I guess, because I started my dissertation during the pandemic, I've been very isolated in my work, working, mm-hmm. Even though I'm a community-based researcher, I've been working out of my home, in my bedroom, in my kitchen, which I'm where I am now. And I haven't had a chance to be very connected with other PhD students. So it was really nice to get talking to other people and connect over similar challenges and also exciting opportunities. And it was just really nice to meet a range of people doing so much interesting work in Southern Ontario. Like, it was just great. Yeah.
And that's why I love it. I mean, our listeners have heard it year after year, how the Lake Shift Riding Retreat is one of my favorite events to be a part of, because it is exciting to hear all the different research that is going on and listen to the different conversations and, you know, cross-disciplinary, cross-university. Mm-hmm. It's brilliant. And mm-hmm. I hope all our students come away feeling rejuvenated, both mm-hmm. in body and in mind, because I certainly do when I go home.
But mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's great that you were able to join us.
I saw some friends the next day and they said, you are a new woman, because I'd been very stressed and anxious before I went. So it was really needed, actually. It was great.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting too, because you said you started this journey during the pandemic, which is not easy, an easy place to start. I mean, we all know doing a PhD can be a lonely experience, but even more so during that period of time. How are you finding it now that we're outside of that?
Oh, well, I mean, I'm still working in isolation. I live in Hamilton. I'm not very connected with my community at TMU as much as I'd like to be. Mm-hmm. That being said, I've gained a lot of connection through the research community at TMU more than my own program. So I'm part of the Center for Studies in Food Security, and it's been what I've considered to be like my home base and where people are with like-minded research, and also found a lot of mentorship and guidance and opportunity within that space. But yeah, the pandemic, it's funny because I know for so many people it had been a time where a lot of trauma and hardship has happened. I think for me and my family it was a good time to reset because I had lost touch with what was important, and I was working a lot and I was very career focused and I didn't have a lot of time for my children, and I've rearranged my life to be more present for them and home centric. So it was a blessing in disguise, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think it's great too. I mean, I totally agree. It was a time for us all to sit back and reflect on, mm-hmm. you know, what are our priorities are important in our lives today, mm-hmm. Which was great. But I also like the fact that you said, even though you're living in Hamilton, you've managed to find a way to make connections at the university, mm-hmm. Particularly in a topic that is clearly of interest to you, which comes to the research. And that was a segue into your research topic. And so, Janelle, your research topic for everyone is food security and food insecurity responses on the municipal level. So I guess, firstly, you know, what is your background anyway? Because you were working, you come back to do some study. So what is your background and what made you want to get into that?
Yeah, I always have a hard time talking about my research without talking about how I came into it. So pre-pandemic, I was a project manager at a pretty large food diversion organization called Second Harvest. Right. And food diversion is when you work with a bunch of partners and making sure that food doesn't get wasted. So they work with a range of industry partners, but also many hundreds of community-based organizations that are running food programming. And that is quite diverse. It's food banks, meal programs, after-school programs, senior programs. It's quite diverse. It's not just food banks, which I think a lot of people assume. Mm-hmm. And when the pandemic happened, I was part of the program's team that was asked to be part of the emergency operations unit within the city of Toronto. And they were also asked to be part of a national food response team with the federal government. Being part of the program's team meant that I did sit on the table with a bunch of colleagues that were working in this space and collaborated with the city of Toronto in making sure that there was an adequate response to the heightened food insecurity that happened in the first phases of the pandemic. And that is still occurring, to be honest. It hasn't. Mm-hmm. We aren't out of it yet. We're still there. And for me at the time, I was in a tiny condo in Toronto without childcare. I was having meetings in the hallway of the condo where I wasn't supposed to be. A kid couldn't go on the playground because it was all roped off because of whatever concerns public health had about playgrounds being a source of contamination. I'm not sure why. It was really hard. So I wasn't able to keep that position. And I had a team of really great colleagues that kind of took the lead with that. And the same week of that pandemic, I got my acceptance letter to go to TMU for my PhD.
Oh, that was fortuitous.
There was a lot of kind of...
The stars aligned.
Yes,
in one way.
There was a lot of big decisions that had to happen that week. And deciding to pursue academia was an opportunity to take a beat, mm-hmm. pull back a little bit from the community work. But also, it was really important to me to keep my foot in the community And if I'm going to go into academia, it has to be community-centered research.
Right.
So my supervisor and I, at the time, developed a proposal for SHRC. There was a special COVID grant. And we applied in partnership with the City of Toronto to kind of assess the emergency response. But we are looking at the community organizations and rather than the impact on residents. So some people think that's a little bit confusing, but because there were 400 organizations responding to the crisis in at first a very uncoordinated way, they developed some systems of coordination and wanted to have some means of capturing what that looked like and what were some of the assets that made it work, what were some of the vulnerabilities. And that's what my team did. So I was hired as a HQP, a highly qualified personnel.
Sounds good.
Yes, yeah.
Put that after your name.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's just in lieu of I couldn't be like the principal investigator because right. I wasn't yet an academic like faculty member in the eyes of SHRC. So I couldn't be that person. I had to be an HQP and Sarah was the PI. And we developed a team and we interviewed there was around 30 organizations that we interviewed, about a dozen of the municipal staff that were kind of pivotal in the food security response. And through that work, there was a very applied research framework there where we ended up with a kind of a report and we did a knowledge mobilization event at the end of that research. So I actually, as a PhD student, typically you would start doing your research in your second or third year, second year after you write your proposal and you defend your comps and all that. But I jumped in doing my proposal writing in the summer before I started my program, like in the heat of in the moment, and then submitted that proposal with Sarah. She did a lot of the heavy lifting at that point and then hit the ground running, starting research in January of, was that 2021? So it was still when, I'm not sure it was still like considered like first wave, but we were able to reflect on what happened in that first wave.
Right.
And capture what the strengths were within the city and within the community, and to look at vulnerabilities and where they can strengthen in the likelihood of some other sort of crisis. And we can see too that there was a lot of research on climate crisis vulnerabilities in the city, but nothing really about this sort of crisis before.
It's interesting. You just talked then about you were able to sort of capture what was going on in the first wave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you had the report. Were you able to also capture, maybe it's outside the scope, the second wave and anything that got learned from the first that got changed for the second?
That's a good question. So, I mean, it wasn't divided in waves because we were going through the research when obviously those timelines overlapped. Mm-hmm. And we were doing interviews over like a 6 to 8 month period.
Right.
So I think we didn't have a very clear timeline, even knowing that there was waves at the time. We didn't really have that kind of bird's eye view of what the pandemic would look like. So not entirely, but what happened with that first, I would say, phase of research when we interviewed the community organizations and the municipality, one of the big things that came out of those conversations was a real positive collaboration that happened between different organizations across the city and with the city, as well as funders. So a big piece of that was how flexible, when in crisis, money can flow. Mm-hmm. And don't forget, during this time, there was the murder of George Floyd and the mobilization of the Black Lives Movement. A lot of attention brought towards the 215 unmarked graves in Kamloops.
Right.
And a resurgence and attention to Indigenous reconciliation. So these kind of overlapping social tensions were pushing the range of actors to think a little bit more critically of the work that they're doing. Mm-hmm. And to be more mindful about supporting and directing resources where it's needed most. And a result of that is a lot of community organizations, especially those that are like housed within and led by Black communities or newcomer communities or Indigenous communities, there was a suddenly like money flowing in ways that hadn't before. Okay. And a lot of those barriers being kind of reduced during that time. And so that kind of moved into my second phase of research, was looking at what were funders doing to change their practices to be more inclusive and thoughtful and critical and supportive of different groups of people without being performative. And so
because that's easy to do. Yeah.
And actually, to be honest, I think a lot of the things that people were doing were out of crisis and out of like not having a lot of time to even manage and have oversight over funds and just kind of letting money flow. But that shift in how people were dealing with resources was really incredibly beneficial to organizations, because suddenly they had less reporting requirements. The application processes for getting funds to serve their communities was reduced. A lot of organizations, especially those leading within like Black communities or those leading in like communities that are densely populated with immigrant populations, they don't have time to be competing for funds. And often they struggle to do the important work that they have to do while also looking for resources to keep that work going. So they saw a lot of benefits of just like the reduction of barriers to funds, and were able to also have more conversations about broader policy change that's needed to make sure that equity and access continues and isn't a performative act.
Because you talk about equities and you know, EDI practices and things, which is super, super important. And as you mentioned too, during the pandemic, because we were at a point of crisis, some of the red tape went out the door. You know, we don't have months to make a decision. We need to make it now because people are going to be hungry or whatever is being put out there. But were you able to show so far with some of your reporting that, you know, this service can still work without all the red tape?
Exactly.
And as long as we still have to be fiscally responsible, because we've got to be able to continue it.
Yeah.
But we don't always need the red tape, and we've proven it.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's something that I've captured a little bit in my second manuscript, which just got gone through the publication process.
Good job.
This week, which I it's not available yet, but it's in the Journal of Food, Culture and Society, which is a British-based journal.
Fantastic.
I'm excited about. And I wrote about those changes and how we can continue working in that space without the looming crisis over our heads, and to keep on practicing equitable distribution of resources. But in reality, I think a lot of funders have kind of gone back to older kind of top-down approaches, despite this kind of rhetoric of trust-based funding being quite popular in the sector. I'm not in funding. I have like kind of periphery experiences being somebody who's applied for money many times, but don't know exactly how decision making happens on their end. But what I do see is that a number of funders and philanthropists and foundations, even municipal government funding programs, have done a lot to kind of change internal practices to be less restrictive and to be more thoughtful about equitable distribution, and to reduce those barriers to groups of people that had historically been kept out of the resource pool, basically. And a lot of that has to do with organizations being so small that they don't have maybe charitable status, but then they have to work with a trustee, and there's a whole range of problems with that kind of structure within the funding landscape.
So clearly there's a lot of different groups involved in helping community-based food security. So from various levels of government to philanthropic organizations to Joe Blow down the road to the food bank, you know, Second Harvest, those sorts of groups, lots of different levels. Is there a way that you would like to create some sort of model to show, well, you know, because we do have to be accountable, but we also need to be responsive to what's going on in our communities. So is there a way of figuring out, okay, so various government levels, we need to perhaps do this process a little bit more because it's taxpayers' money, blah, blah, blah. But then other groups could do this, another, and then the groups like the food banks and Second Harvest and those other sorts of groups have a bit more freedom or whatever. But we still need to get food and money to them to be able to distribute. So this clearly has to be a flow, but there needs to be different levels perhaps to get the process there quicker.
Right. So I think before we talk about community level resource distribution, which is a big part of what my research is on, I do want to bring attention to the fact that these organizations are doing this work because of a failure of the system. Right. So there is a lack of social policy, or there's gaps in social policy that create the situation where people are food insecure in the first place that need to access particular types of programs like food banks. And I will say that there is a range of programs that are available that aren't food banks that are really important, that even if you are food secure, you can access and should access, and they're really important for the community. But for those that are really centered on food insecurity, they are overwhelmed. They're spread thin. They don't never have enough resources. Even if they get all the resources that are available to them, there's always a need that's beyond their capacity. And this is a problem. What we need to do to kind of lessen the burden on the community level response is to make sure that, and this might be provincially, it could be having proper minimum wage standards, or even people are exploring universal basic income. This is something that a lot of advocates are pushing for, making sure that there's some sort of security in housing, because there's a terrible housing crisis, not just in Canada, but internationally. These are things that need to come from upper levels of government to make sure that we aren't overburdened with these crises on the ground level in communities, in municipalities. So the municipal government can do a lot to address food system issues, but they can't be the only, it can't be the only place that's addressing these issues. There's provincial responsibility, there's federal responsibility, and at the municipal level, the best thing that municipal departments can do is support those that are doing the work on the ground, and also be flexible with things like zoning, be flexible with things like funding. There's a whole range of like policy things within the municipality that they can do to support food systems and food security, but ultimately we need federal level and provincial level policy change.
We need to stop it before it gets to that situation.
Exactly.
And I mean, that's a last stop gap, but it's not really a solution per se.
Yeah, it's funny because everybody in this community always says that food banks and food programs or other kind of community-based programs are band-aid solutions. And I had heard one food bank director say it's not a band-aid, it's a tourniquet. And like I think that's more accurate. It's trying to stop people from dying. So these spaces are not band-aids. They're much needed tourniquets to prevent people from completely falling through the cracks.
Cracks. Mm-hmm. You know, I almost wish sometimes, and maybe they still do, but I know when I was growing up, there was always, in primary school, we always had lunchtime, a hot meal was given to everybody. And if you could afford it, you paid 12p. And if you couldn't, you got it for free. So that was to ensure every child went home and had at least one good hot meal a day.
Right. Yeah. I wish
they would bring things like that back.
You know what they are, actually? There's a really great team called the Coalition for Student Nutrition. They are connected with CMU. They're connected with the Canadian Association for Food Studies. They've been advocating for a universal student nutrition program across Canada for years. And in this, I think it was in February, there was an announcement from the federal government that they were going to support and plan and develop and launch a universal student nutrition program. So that's really important. But I also think that some people would say that this isn't addressing the problem still, right?
Well, that's true. Yes, that's true. Because, because this is a problem now that the parents haven't been able to afford to give them a decent meal. So why can't the parents afford it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So even with amazing things like student nutrition programs, which is important, and even if you're not food insecure, I still think it's really important because there's a lot of socialization around food that we see in daycares. And then as soon as students go to school in elementary school, a lot of that socialization around food is gone. So, yeah.
So what else are you trying to highlight?
Yeah.
In your research, because we can do some research and that's great, but for something in particular like this, is it bringing some recommendations? Is it just making people more aware? Is it showing the government, now we need to do, we can solve this if you do this?
Yeah, so I think my research has two parts. There's a kind of applied research component and there's more of a academic or theoretical contribution that I'm working on. I think for the applied piece, there was a lot of that kind of front-end crisis planning and future crisis prevention planning that there's a 60-page report that we published that's available on the website of the Center for Studies in Food Security. That was one component. A second component is I'm currently working with a couple community leaders to develop guidelines for funders on equitable practices, making sure that they're walking the talk or talking the walk or whatever however you'd frame that, and also not co-opting language of community, which we do see happening, especially when community organizations are talking about Black sovereignty or Indigenous reconciliation or food justice. They're using that language that is community language, not funder language, and those things shouldn't be co-opted. So we're working on a report that's guidelines around that for funders. And so that could be folks that are working in philanthropy or working in foundations or even government levels where there's granting programs. Right. This kind of report is important for them. So on the more theoretical or academic side of things, these conversations about food insecurity and what needs to be done, I think my contribution is really highlighting the importance of not just including community voices into policy discussions, but also just taking the lead, letting community take the lead. And we see that this is really happening with the Black Food Sovereignty Movement in Toronto, a group of really hardworking individuals that have been supporting Black food security for 25, 30 years. It was because the city really started to see that, there was communities that were not accessing funding, that were completely left out of the conversation because of their organizational structures. And so started working with them a little bit more and the Confronting Anti-Black Racism Unit to develop a Black food sovereignty plan that was adopted into the city council. So we see really good examples of this happening within the Black community, and we see some examples of this happening within the Indigenous Prosperity Plan with the city. But there's also newcomer communities that should be also being listened to and leading municipal policy and making sure that they have an influence on priorities. So that's one piece of it.
So what's next for you, Janelle? I mean, because you clearly come from this background, you know, from what you described that you were working in. Now you've taken a sidestep to sort of all those things that you were seeing going on, etc. You've had a chance to get into the academic side of it to be able to put a voice or to pull together what's going on. So what's the next part to this for you? What are you hoping for next? Continue in academia or to go back in and help make sure it all gets changed?
I do think that the academic space has been really great for me. I successfully got funding to do a postdoc.
Fantastic. So congratulations.
I can't speak to exactly what that research will be quite yet, but I do strongly believe in making sure that all my work is community-based. Right. I really would like to contribute and give back to people that are interested in doing similar work. So mentoring other folks that are interested in contributing to these conversations, I really hope that I'll be able to do that. I am currently working, like I said, with a group out of Rexdale that are developing a social supermarket. So we're moving into a pilot stage and we're experimenting with this kind of project. So I'm looking at what are some other community assets leaders on a community level are trying to address the issues that they're experiencing with the resources and the assets and the infrastructure that they have. So I want to profile that work and to try and support community organizations to be able to like leverage academic spaces to get support and resources and to bring attention to the hard work that they're doing. So that's where I'm at right now. I'm really not sure where it will lead, but it turns out that community organizations love research, so I'm happy to be there.
Well, because it's already been proven that until they get that research, people may not listen.
So. Right, exactly. So,
And this is a problem that isn't going away anytime soon, mm-hmm. unfortunately. So maybe it needs people like yourself to keep putting that fight in there and finding other ways and chatting to both sides, to be perfectly honest, really.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Everyone's got to come. So, Janelle, that's awesome. It's, you know, whether it's here in Canada or somewhere else in the world, it's something that we need to do more with. So, Janelle, thanks for coming on the show. Really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Claire.
To everyone at TMU.
Thank you.
And wish you all the best of luck.
Thanks, Claire.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Grad Chat. Sego.
Bonjour, Anim.
Danach A. Ak Anzeni Shukwithan.
Tonse.
Ay, Inuhalikay.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Tonse, and welcome to Words and Culture. I'm your Cree host, Michael Hutchinson. Today we're off to my people's home area, Missipuistic, or Grand Rapids, Manitoba, as it's known in English. Missipuistic is two words put together that mean big rapids. Missi, meaning big, and Puistic, meaning rapids. I'm going to take you to visit my auntie, Stella Neff, who is a language keeper and a knowledge keeper, and is an elder in my community and beyond. She's going to bake us some bannock with her chapan, her great-grandchild, and explain to us about the meaning of that Cree word, chapan. Stella is my second cousin, but in Cree culture, where extended family means a lot, she is my auntie. Before we set out for Missipuistic, Words and Culture producer Kim Wheeler and I headed out for some provisions.
Were you instructed to pick up, Michael?
I was instructed to pick up baking supplies for bannock, so flour and raisins and I guess baking powder?
Baking powder, yes. Okay, I heard that baking powder is a really important ingredient and people have They're specific about their baking powder.
Are they? I'm not certain if my auntie's that way, because she wasn't very specific about the flour, because back in the old days, my grandma would only use Robin Hood flour.
Raisins.
Thompson raisins. We're going to Grand Rapids, which is on the way to Thompson, so Thompson raisins sounds like a good plan.
Okay, controversial putting raisins in bannock, I'm sure.
Yes, well, it's almost like pineapple and pizza, but we're going to go for it.
Okay, and we're headed off to
Grand Rapids, Missipuistic in Cree. Before we get into my Auntie Stella's home, I just want to give the listeners a trigger warning. We do talk about the traumas of residential school.
Dancey.
Kinamaga.
I was just mopping up my floor.
This is Kim.
Hi, Kim.
And this is my Auntie Stella.
Hi. Hi, nice to meet you.
Good. Here.
It's good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you.
I got your flour and raisins.
Good.
How are you doing?
Oh, it smells so good in here already.
Cool. I had old bananas I have to use up this morning. Actually, they've been on the counter since Tuesday.
So they were kind of black?
They were kind of getting black. And then Tuesday I got, rabbits. So I had to skin those, and then I got chickens the day after, and then I got goose yesterday, so banana bread was last on the list.
Well, that sounds great. Goose, rabbit, and chickens.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And then Kevin dropped off sturgeon, which was the best.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Kevin's my brother.
Yeah. Yeah. You sit down. Let's talk about it.
On this brisk winter's day, my Auntie Stella has one of her great-granddaughters with her, Jetta. She's almost a teenager, and they are making bannock together. Well, Jetta is making bannock, and Auntie Stella is supervising.
Go wash your hands, yeah. Go wash your hands first. Yeah, she's been making bannock every day. And after the first day, I said, "Boy, you're good." I said, I didn't help her in any way. And she says, "Well, remember, Coco, I won first prize 2 years ago when I was 9 years old at our Christmas party.
Okay.
We usually have a bannock bake-off with the kids."
Oh.
And she won. I said, "I forgot about that."
So you won a bannock making contest, I heard.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
There was a Christmas party out of our family. All of us went there. And then before we had like the party, we had a bannock bake-off thing. And that was the first time I ever made bannock on my own, because before that I was making bannock with my mom and mama, and that wasn't the first time ever I made bannock by myself, and I won first place.
Against your cousins.
Jetta is learning Cree in school, and I asked her what are some of the things that she's learning to say in Cree.
Animals and some words, and we're learning how to write in syllabics.
Oh, okay. So she's your chapan. Can you tell us a little bit about the word chapan?
It actually means when you say chapan, it means Eutapian, which means I'm pulling. Like when you're pulling somebody in a sled, Eutapian anima, that's what you call Eutapian. Well, that's what chapan, that's where the word comes from. So I'm pulling the past for her. And her, she's a chapan, so she pulls that into the future. That's what chapan means, Eutapian. Put some flour on it, a little bit for you. That's where the word chapan comes from. Yeah. It's the word otapian, that I'm pulling the past for her. And she pulls it into the future. It's the same word. She calls me chapan and I call her chapan. And it doesn't... It's in between, like you have your mom and dad, and then the Musum Nukum, and then the Nukum, the Musum, and then the Chapan, and then over here is the Tanis, Negosis, and the Chapan. So the seven words are on either side, the Chapan. The old lady is a Chapan, and the youngest one is a Chapan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have the rest for
10 minutes? Yeah. We need more flour on there, yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about, how did you learn Cree?
Well, in Grand Rapids, 70 years ago, everybody spoke Cree. There's no such thing. The only English-speaking people here were the teachers, maybe the store, not even the store manager, because Mrs. Campbell spoke Cree. The only other one was the priest or the minister, the Anglican minister and the priest, those are the only ones that spoke English. So everybody spoke Cree. everybody. It's this Manitoba Hydro coming into town with 2,000 people and making a bigger school. It's in my generation we've lost the language, because we were strapped when we got to school. Like, I was strapped every day just because I spoke Cree. Because when you only know a language, that's all you use, you don't know that these people are not talking your language. And I got strapped every day. And then I'm the oldest, so my parents said, don't speak Cree to your brothers and sisters anymore, because we don't want them hit when they get to school. So that's how we started. The little English we learned, we spoke to all the younger ones. And then so it's right in the middle there, like Herbie, Cameron, Ellen, Richard, Ronnie, they all spoke Cree. And all the rest they didn't learn Cree. Because of that, just because of that, my parents didn't want them hit when they got to school. So, and then they get mad at us, like Michael and Donald and Dunstan and Joanne, and get mad at us because, why did you listen? Why did you listen and speak to us Cree? I said, we wanted to protect you too, so you don't get hit when you get to school. So that's what happened. They didn't learn the language. But I would say Michael now is in the PAW, so he's learning language because he drives bus for the elderly at the McGilver Care Home. So he's learning Cree, and then Joanne was learning Cree because she's working as a nurse. So it's just my generation, we lost it because of that, because of the policies of the government to kill the language in the child. It was happened down there. It's not just a residential school. It happened here in the school, because we were strapped and we didn't learn the language. I mean, we didn't speak the language anymore because of those 200 kids that started school and they're speaking English and dressing in white people's clothes, and they used to make fun of us that they're dressed, smelled smoky. Well, of course we smelled smoky. We had wood stoves. Yeah, it was a destructive force, that hydro. This was the last house. Over there was the other house. All of this was bush. There was no highway because we didn't have vehicles. We didn't have vehicles in my lifetime. We had no noisy vehicles like cars or trucks or anything. We had, the river was our highway, and we had the boats, and then the dog teams is what we used. My dad had, everybody had dog teams, and so we didn't really need these big roads, big highways, because we didn't have vehicles. It's only when Manitoba Hydro built this Highway 6 is only made in 1960. 1960s, I guess, they started building Highway 6, and they only built it as far as here. The one to Thompson was built later on in 1970, I think. Because people were in the way over there with Manitoba Hydro, they moved them over here. They expropriated the land from... Remember, they used to live by the Anglican Church? No, the Catholic Church. Oh, hell. Mecordies, both Mecordies. These are Mecordies. That's Mecordies. And they lived by the church. Well, they took them away from there because they built the forestry there. So they moved them over here. They made them move over here. They put them there. And then they got so upset because they bulldozed their houses. They were beautiful log buildings. And they just bulldozed them down because they wanted them to move over here because they were in the way. They were in the way for their construction. A lot of people, they did that to a lot of people. Like where the bridge is, they had a house across there. Norman Chief lived across there. On this side, the Prantos lived there. And then the Prantos were probably Métis. But then they just expropriated that land. They just told them to move. And then they didn't want to move anywhere else. And they moved to Winnipeg. And there was a family of five boys. And within a few years, all five had been killed in Winnipeg, and violently, those ones, Walter and Wilfred and John and Harry. There was five boys. They were all killed violently in Winnipeg because they were forced to leave Grand Rapids. I get so upset because there was no consideration for them that they, well, maybe you do want to live over here? No, it's just so you live over here, and that was it. And they didn't want to live here.
Can you tell us a little bit about the rapids, you know, and a lot, you know, that the ancestors and the, what they used, what the people used to say about the rapids before, and then what happened when they went silent?
Well, like I said, the river was our highway, and in the summer, that's how we traveled. There was actually a tramway there, the original tramway from the 1800s, and you could go up there to the top of the rapids, because the rapids is built like this, and then we're here, and then we'd walk up there, and then my dad would take the boat up, and then we'd meet him over there and go further up into the river system, because it's not just Grand Rapids. There was five rapids between here and Chemawawand, which is Easterville. The original home of Easterville is Chemawawand. And we traveled up there, and that's where the hunting was done, that's where the berry picking was done, and that's where all the other life was done, hunting for trapping and fishing was this way, because the lake was too big and too dangerous for us when you didn't have any big boats. We just had little boats. We didn't have great big, like over there, that big yawl. And that's where we traveled. And it was when the flooding, when they closed that dam, we lost all that way of life. We lost where my dad used to hunt rabbit, and moose, and we lost all the things we used to pick berries or medicine or whatever they did before, because it was all flooded. And that's the boreal forest that was flooded. If you look this way now, it's all muskeg. There are so many things that I miss from that lifestyle, because we used to have, when I came back home, like I've been home 23 years now, I missed so many birds. I missed so many animals, like porcupine. Well, I haven't seen a porcupine in 50 years because the boreal forest is gone, because that's where they live. They like eating the aspen and the leaf trees. And
as we sit and visit on this Saturday afternoon, Jetta continues to make bannock. She comes in and out of the kitchen, so I asked her if she could count to 10 for me. She did, with a little help from her chapan.
Piak. So repeat after me.
Piak.
Niso.
Niso.
Nisto.
Nisto.
Neo.
Neo.
Nianan.
Niana.
Negutosik.
Negutosik.
Tepegup.
Tepegup.
Enaneo.
Kenanyo.
That's mitatat.
Mesradatata.
Mitatat, yeah.
Batata?
Yeah. That's 10.
When Jetta leaves the kitchen to return to watching TV, it doesn't take Auntie Stella long to turn back to the history of Missipuistic.
In my lifetime, I've seen the destruction of this culture, because in my lifetime, from birth to death, we looked after each other. We had midwives here. We didn't have to run over to the Paw and run off to Winnipeg or run off to Ashland to have babies. We had midwives.
Well, you kind of talked about the land and the changes here. Like, you know, when I asked my mom, why didn't you teach me Cree?
Yeah.
She said, if you had a bush accent, you'd never be able to get a job.
Yeah, exactly.
So what are your thoughts on that?
That's exactly it. It's exactly it, the way that we were treated if you spoke Cree. It's the whole system, like even being in school, being hit in school because you talk Cree. They didn't want anybody to speak Cree. And now they want everybody to speak Cree. There's pathetic teachers, people that don't know the language, how to teach Cree. I said, it's so late. Because when I sit and talk to people, a lot of the times they don't understand anymore. They don't understand the language. They don't understand those deeper words, a deeper meaning that explain our culture. It's really sad that we've lost our language so much. When you think of even names of birds, when I think of my godfather in Easterville, Arthur Ballantyne, I visited him. His birthday was in April, and I visited him, and he'd say, what's Tagupano? And name all these birds, the ones that have already arrived, the ones that he's been waiting for. And he named them all the little birds that would come in the spring, eh? And I'm sitting there listening, I haven't heard that, I should write that down. But I didn't want to have paper to write it down. I'll remember when I get to the car. I get to the car, I forget. I'm so sorry I didn't go back and ask him, because we named everything. We didn't use crow or magpie or all these words that we use now, because we named absolutely everything in this world. We didn't need English to rely on. And we do that so much. We rely so much on English for people. They use, when they're talking, they say skulik at the school. Instead, nikarim, instead of tapanask. They say, for school, they say skulik. They use so much English size.
So it's bastardized words, yeah, to kind of add a little, yeah, bit of Cree just to the end,
yeah,
of it.
Yeah, just to put the beginning at the end, yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, there's, like, people are learning Cree, but it's sort of a surface Cree.
Cree is not the deep Cree. When they started university, I was so excited, because I admire deep thinkers, I admire intelligence, and when I was in university, I just loved things like psychology, philosophy, sociology, because it goes into the deeper, and then mythology. And then when they started talking about University College of the North, oh my goodness, it'll be so exciting, because they'll teach these courses, they'll teach about our stories that we have. And I said, and we could write them down and record them, because in there is what we really believe about the world.
As our visit comes to a close, Jetta comes back to check in on the Bannock.
What, is it ready? Is it?
It looks a little white still.
Let's see. We'll turn that light on. Wastepita, I should say. I'll check it.
How do you say it's done?
I say.
Oh, it looks good.
Yep, it does. Okay, turn it off. Okay. Looks good. Flip it over so it won't get wet. Amazing.
Nice and golden.
Yeah, it's nice and golden, yeah.
So how do you feel about her learning Cree in school now then?
Well, it's better than... I'm disappointed. Like, they've been teaching 7 years while they're still just doing animals and verbs. We should be learning things like some of the words that are more meaningful. because it's so basic still, like Minugisiga, of course, nice day, and Utaksik, it's Gigiluan, yesterday it rained. It's so basic, the language, after so many years. I get really disappointed in how little is being taught in Cree, because our speakers are dying. That's the sad thing.
I wanted to know more about this idea of a deeper Cree, so I asked Auntie Stella to teach me some.
The one thing we were always taught about is Ushchene.
Ushchene.
Ushchene. It's a result of something that you have done that is not right, and it's sort of like punishment for not doing right. Like if you torture animals, surely you will also sometimes suffer, someday suffer because of it.
Ushchene.
Ushchene, yeah.
It almost sounds a little bit like karma.
It is. But I don't know the full meaning of what karma is, because it's...
From a different culture,
yeah,
but...
Yeah, it's a different culture. But it's very, very... it was taught a lot to us not to do things that will cause us to have ushchene. And that's one thing that we don't teach our children.
I remember hearing a story when I was young about a girl who teased another girl.
Yeah.
And then that first girl's baby was born with the blemish that she teased that other girl about.
Yeah. Yeah, that's ushchene. Yeah.
So yeah. What you put out in the universe,
yeah,
will come back to you.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other one that I really believe in, and I really... think is being lost when you say is amatiso. Amatiso.
Amatiso.
Yeah. It's when you receive a sign to be wary because something is going to happen to you.
Now, there's not really a word for goodbye in Cree, but we use ekose. As we head off on our 5-hour drive back to Winnipeg, my Auntie Stella has given me a lot to think about. I turn the car onto Highway 6 and listen to another Missipawistic citizen, Matthew Cook Contois. He's a master fiddle player as well as a singer-songwriter. This is his band Eagle Ex Machina and Verbal Thoroughfare. We'll see you next time on Words and Culture. Be well, stay smiling.
Stars never show nobody how. Since reaching out, yeah. a dream.